When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
Section 15 of Moll Flanders by Daniel Defoe. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. Section 15. Moll Flanders. My comrade, having the brand of an old offender, was executed. The young offender was spared, having obtained a reprieve, but lay starving a long while in prison, till at last she got her name into what they call a circuit pardon, and so came off. This terrible example of my comrade frightened me heartily, and for a good while I made no excursions. But one night, in the neighbourhood of my governess's house, they cried, "Fire!" My governess looked out, for we were all up, and cried immediately that such a gentleman's house was all of a light, fire atop, and so indeed it was. Here she gives me a job. "Now, child," says she, "there is a rare opportunity, for the fire being so near that you may go to it before the street is blocked up with the crowd." She presently gave me my cue. "Go, child," says she, "to the house, and run in and tell the lady, or anybody you see, that you come to help them, and that you came from such a gentlewoman," that is, one of her acquaintance farther up the street. She gave me the like cue to the next house, naming another name that was also an acquaintance of the gentlewoman of the house. Away I went, and coming to the house, I found them all in confusion, you may be sure. I ran in, and finding one of the maids, "Lord, sweetheart," says I, "how came this dismal accident? Where is your mistress, and how does she do? Is she safe? And where are the children? I come from Madame Blank to help you." Away runs the maid. "Madam, madam," says she, screaming as loud as she could yell, "here is a gentlewoman come from Madame Blank to help us." The poor woman, half out of her wits, with a bundle under her arm and two little children, comes towards me. "Lord, madam," says I, "let me carry the poor children to Madame Blank. She desires you to send them. She'll take care of the poor lambs." And immediately I takes one of them out of her hand, and she lifts the other up into my arms. "I do, for God's sake," says she, "carry them to her. Oh, thank her for her kindness." "Have you anything else to secure, madam?" says I. "She will take care of it." "Oh, dear, I," says she, "God bless her and thank her. Take this bundle of plate and carry it to her too. Oh, she is a good woman. Oh, Lord, we are utterly ruined, utterly undone." And away she runs from me out of her wits, and the maids after her, and away comes I with the two children and the bundle. I was no sooner got into the street, but I saw another woman come to me. "Oh," says she, "mistress," in a piteous tone, "you will let fall the child. Come, this is a sad time, let me help you," and immediately lays hold of my bundle to carry it for me. "No," says I, "if you will help me, take the child by the hand and lead it for me, but to the upper end of the street. I'll go with you and satisfy you for your pains." She could not avoid going, after what I said, but the creature, in short, was one of the same business with me, and wanted nothing but the bundle. However, she went with me to the door, for she could not help it. When we were come there, I whispered her, "Go, child," said I understand your trade. You may meet with purchase enough." She understood me, and walked off. I thundered at the door with the children, and as the people were raised before by the noise of the fire, I was soon let in, and I said, "Is madam awake? Pray tell her Mrs. Blank desires the favour of her to take the two children in. Poor lady, she will be undone. Their house is all of a flame." They took the children in very civilly, pitied the family in distress, and away came I with my bundle. One of the maids asked me if I was not to leave the bundle too. I said, "No, sweetheart, 'tis to go to another place. It does not belong to them." I was in a great way out of the hurry now, and so I went on, clear of anybody's inquiry, and brought the bundle of plate, which was very considerable, straight home, and gave it to my old governess. She told me she would not look into it, but bade me go out again to look for more. She gave me the like cue to the gentlewoman of the next house, to that which was on fire, and I did my endeavour to go, but by this time the alarm of fire was so great, and so many engines playing, and the streets so thronged with people, that I could not get near the house, whatever I would do. So I came back again to my governess's, and taking the bundle up into my chamber, I began to examine it. It is with horror that I tell what a treasure I found there. 'Tis enough to say that besides most of the family plate, which was considerable, I found a gold chain, an old-fashioned thing, the locket of which was broken, so that I suppose it had not been used some years, but the gold was not the worse for that. Also a little box of burying rings, the lady's wedding ring, and some broken bits of old lockets of gold, a gold watch, and a purse with about £24 value in old pieces of gold coin, and several other things of value. This was the greatest and the worst prize that ever I was concerned in, for indeed, though, as I have said above, I was hardened now beyond the power of all reflection in other cases, yet it really touched me to the very soul when I looked into this treasure, to think of the poor disconsolate gentlewoman who had lost so much by the fire besides, and who would think, to be sure, that she had saved her plate and best things. How she would be surprised and afflicted when she should find that she had been deceived, and should find that the person that took her children and her goods had not come, as was pretended, from the gentlewoman in the next street, but that the children had been put upon her without her own knowledge. I say, I confess the inhumanity of this action moved me very much, and made me relent exceedingly, and tears stood in my eyes upon that subject. But, with all my sense of its being cruel and inhuman, I could never find in my heart to make any restitution. The reflection wore off, and I began quickly to forget the circumstances that attended the taking them. Nor was this all, for though by this job I was become considerably richer than before, yet the resolution I had formerly taken of leaving off this horrid trade when I had gotten a little more did not return, but I must still get farther and more, and the avarice joined so with the success that I had no more thought of coming to a timely alteration of life, though without it I could expect no safety, no tranquillity in the possession of what I had so wickedly gained. But a little more and a little more was the case still. At length, yielding to the importunities of my crime, I cast off all remorse and repentance, and all the reflections on that head turned to no more than this, that I might perhaps come to have one booty more that might complete my desires, but though I certainly had that one booty, yet every hit looked towards another, and was so encouraging me to go on with the trade that I had no gust to the thought of laying it down. In this condition, hardened by success and resolving to go on, I fell into the snare in which I was appointed to meet with my last reward for this kind of life. But even this was not yet, for I met with several successful adventures more in this way of being undone. I remained still with my governess, who was for a while really concerned for the misfortune of my comrade that had been hanged, and who, it seems, knew enough of my governess to have sent her the same way, and which made her very uneasy. Indeed, she was in a very great fright. It is true that when she was gone, and had not opened mouth to tell what she knew, my governess was easy as to that point, and perhaps glad she was hanged, for it was in her power to have obtained a pardon at the expense of her friends. But, on the other hand, the loss of her, and the sense of her kindness in not making her market of what she knew, moved my governess to mourn very sincerely for her. I comforted her as well as I could, and she, in return, hardened me to merit more completely the same fate. However, as I have said, it made me the more wary, and particularly I was very shy of shoplifting, especially among the mercers and drapers, who are a set of fellows that have their eyes very much about them. I made a venture or two among the lace folks and the milliners, and particularly at one shop where I got notice of two young women who were newly set up and had not been bred to the trade. There, I think, I carried off a piece of bone lace worth £6 or £7, and a paper of thread. But this was but once. It was a trick that would not serve again. It was always reckoned a safe job when we heard of a new shop, and especially when the people were such as were not bred to shops. Such may depend upon it that they will be visited once or twice at their beginning, and they must be very sharp indeed if they can prevent it. I made another adventure or two, but they were but trifles too, though sufficient to live on. After this, nothing considerable offering for a good while, I began to think that I must give over the trade in earnest, but my governess, who was not willing to lose me, and expected great things of me, brought me one day into company with a young woman and a fellow that went for her husband, though, as it appeared afterwards, she was not his wife, but they were partners, it seems, in the trade they carried on, and partners in something else. In short, they robbed together, lay together, were taken together, and at last were hanged together. I came into a kind of league with these two by the help of my governess, and they carried me out into three or four adventures, where I rather saw them commit some coarse and unhandy robberies in which nothing but a great stock of impudence on their side, and gross negligence on the people's side who were robbed, could have made them successful. So I resolved from that time forward to be very cautious how I ventured upon anything with them, and indeed, when two or three unlucky projects were proposed by them, I declined the offer and persuaded them against it. One time they particularly proposed robbing a watchmaker of three gold watches which they had eyed in the daytime, and found the place where he laid them. One of them had so many keys of all kinds that he made no question to open the place where the watchmaker had laid them, and so we made a kind of an appointment, but when I came to look narrowly into the thing, I found they proposed breaking open the house, and this, as a thing out of my way, I would not embark in, so they went without me. They did get into the house by main force, and broke up the locked place where the watches were, but found but one of the gold watches, and a silver one which they took, and got out of the house again very clear. But the family, being alarmed, cried out, "Thieves!" and the man was pursued and taken. The young woman had got off too, but unhappily was stopped at a distance, and the watches found upon her. And thus I had a second escape, for they were convicted, and both were hanged, being old offenders, though but young people. As I said before, that they robbed together and lay together, so now they hanged together, and there ended my new partnership. I began now to be very wary, having so narrowly escaped a scouring, and having such an example before me. But I had a new tempter, who prompted me every day, I mean my governess, and now a prize presented, which, as it came by her management, so she expected a good share of the booty. There was a good quantity of Flanders lace lodged in a private house, where she had gotten intelligence of it, and Flanders lace being prohibited, it was a good booty to any custom-house officer that could come at it. I had a full account from my governess, as well of the quantity as of the very place where it was concealed, and I went to a custom-house officer and told him I had such a discovery to make to him of such a quantity of lace, if he would assure me that I should have my due share of the reward. This was so just an offer that nothing could be fairer, so he agreed, and taking a constable and me with him, we beset the house. As I told him I could go directly to the place, he left it to me, and the hole being very dark, I squeezed myself into it, with a candle in my hand, and so reached the pieces out to him, taking care as I gave him some, so to secure as much about myself as I could conveniently dispose of. There was near £300 worth of lace in the hole, and I secured about £50 worth of it to myself. The people of the house were not owners of the lace, but a merchant who had entrusted them with it, so that they were not so surprised as I thought they would be. I left the officer, overjoyed with his prize, and fully satisfied with what he had got, and appointed to meet him at a house of his own directing, where I came after I had disposed of the cargo I had about me, of which he had not the least suspicion. When I came to him, he began to capitulate with me, believing I did not understand the right I had to a share in the prize, and would fain have put me off with £20, but I let him know that I was not so ignorant as he supposed I was, and yet I was glad, too, that he offered to bring me to a certainty. I asked £100, and he rose up to £30. I fell to £80, and he rose again to £40. In a word, he offered £50, and I consented, only demanding a piece of lace which I thought came to about £8 or £9, as if it had been for my own wear, and he agreed to it. So I got £50 in money paid me that same night, and made an end of the bargain, nor did he ever know who I was, or where to inquire for me, so that if it had been discovered that part of the goods were embezzled, he could have made no challenge upon me for it. I very punctually divided this spoil with my governess, and I passed with her from this time for a very dexterous manager in the nicest cases. I found that this last was the best and easiest sort of work that was in my way, and I made it my business to inquire out prohibited goods, and after buying some, usually betrayed them. But none of these discoveries amounted to anything considerable, not like that I related just now. But I was willing to act safe, and was still cautious of running the great risks which I found others did, and in which they miscarried every day. The next thing of moment was an attempt at a gentlewoman's good watch. It happened in a crowd at a meeting-house, where I was in a very great danger of being taken. I had full hold of her watch, but giving a great jostle, as if somebody had thrust me against her, and in the juncture giving the watch a fair pull, I found it would not come. So I let it go that moment, and cried out as if I had been killed, that somebody had trod upon my foot, and that there were certainly pickpockets there, for somebody or other had given a pull at my watch. For you are to observe that on these adventures we always went very well dressed, and I had very good clothes on, and a gold watch by my side, as like a lady as other fold. I had no sooner said so, but the other gentlewoman cried out, "A pickpocket!" too, for somebody, she said, had tried to pull her watch away. When I touched her watch, I was close to her, but when I cried out, I stopped, as it were, short, and the crowd bearing her forward a little, she made a noise too, but it was at some distance from me, so that she did not in the least suspect me. But when she cried out, "A pickpocket!" somebody cried, "Aye, and here has been another! This gentlewoman has been attempted too!" At that very instant, a little farther in the crowd, and very luckily too, they cried out, "A pickpocket!" again, and really seized a young fellow in the very act. This, though unhappy for the wretch, was very opportunely for my case, though I had carried it off handsomely enough before. But now it was out of doubt, and all the loose part of the crowd ran that way, and the poor boy was delivered up to the rage of the street, which is a cruelty I need not describe, and which, however, they are always glad of, rather than to be sent to Newgate, where they lie often a long time, till they are almost perished, and sometimes they are hanged, and the best they can look for, if they are convicted, is to be transported. This was a narrow escape to me, and I was so frighted that I ventured no more at gold watches a great while. There was indeed a great many concurring circumstances in this adventure which assisted in my escape, but the chief was that the woman whose watch I had pulled at was a fool, that is to say, she was ignorant of the nature of the attempt, which one would have thought she should not have been, seeing she was wise enough to fasten her watch so that it could not be slipped up. But she was in such a fright that she had no thought about her proper for the discovery, for she, when she felt the pull, screamed out and pushed herself forward and put all the people about her into disorder, and said not a word of her watch or of a pickpocket for at least 2 minutes' time, which was time enough for me in despair. For as I had cried out behind her, as I have said, and bore myself back in the crowd as she bore forward, there were several people, at least 7 or 8, the throng being still moving on, that were got between me and her in that time, and then I crying out, "A pickpocket," rather sooner than she, or at least as soon, she might as well be the person suspected as I, and the people were confused in their inquiry. Whereas had she, with the presence of mind needful on such an occasion, as soon as she felt the pull, not screamed out as she did, but turned immediately round and seized the next body that was behind her, she had infallibly taken me. This is a direction not of the kindest sort to the fraternity, but 'tis certainly a key to the clue of a pickpocket's motions, and whoever can follow it will as certainly catch the thief as he will be sure to miss if he does not. I had another adventure which puts this matter out of doubt, and which may be an instruction for posterity in the case of a pickpocket. My good old governess, to give a short touch at her history, though she had left off the trade, was, as I may say, born a pickpocket, and, as I understood afterwards, had run through all the several degrees of that art, and yet had never been taken but once, when she was so grossly detected that she was convicted and ordered to be transported. But being a woman of a rare tongue, and withal having money in her pocket, she found means, the ship putting into Ireland for provisions, to get on shore there, where she lived and practised her old trade for some years, when, falling into another sort of bad company, she turned midwife and procuress, and played 100 pranks there, which she gave me a little history of in confidence between us as we grew more intimate. and it was to this wicked creature that I owed all the art and dexterity I arrived to, in which there were few that ever went beyond me, or that practised so long without any misfortune. It was after those adventures in Ireland, and when she was pretty well known in that country, that she left Dublin and came over to England, where, the time of her transportation being not expired, she left her former trade, for fear of falling into bad hands again, for then she was sure to have gone to wreck. Here she set up in the same trade she had followed in Ireland, in which she soon, by her admirable management and good tongue, arrived to the height which I have already described, and indeed began to be rich, though her trade fell off again afterwards, as I have hinted before. I mentioned thus much of the history of this woman here, the better to account for the concern she had in the wicked life I was now leading, into all the particulars of which she had led me, as it were, by the hand, and gave me such directions, and I so well followed them that I grew the greatest artist of my time, and worked myself out of every danger with such dexterity that when several more of my comrades ran themselves into Newgate presently, and by that time they had been half a year at the trade, I had now practised upwards of 5 years, and the people at Newgate did not so much as know me. They had heard much of me indeed, and often expected me there, but I always got off, though many times in the extremest danger. One of the greatest dangers I was now in was that I was too well known among the trade, and some of them, whose hatred was owing rather to envy than any injury I had done them, began to be angry that I should always escape when they were always catched and hurried to Newgate. These were they that gave me the name of Moll Flanders, for it was no more of affinity with my real name or with any of the names I had ever gone by than black is of kin to white, except that once, as before, I called myself Mrs. Flanders when I sheltered myself in the mint, but that these rogues never knew, nor could I ever learn how they came to give me the name or what the occasion of it was. I was soon informed that some of these who were gotten fast into Newgate had vowed to impeach me, and as I knew that two or three of them were but too able to do it, I was under a great concern about it, and kept within doors for a good while. But my governess, whom I always made partner in my success, and who now played a sure game with me, for that she had a share of the gain and no share in the hazard, I say my governess was something impatient of my leading such a useless, unprofitable life, as she called it, and she laid a new contrivance for my going abroad, and this was to dress me up in men's clothes, and so put me into a new kind of practice. I was tall and personable, but a little too smooth-faced for a man. However, I seldom went abroad, but in the night. It did well enough. But it was a long time before I could behave in my new clothes, I mean as to my craft. It was impossible to be so nimble, so ready, so dexterous at these things in a dress so contrary to nature, and I did everything clumsily, so I had neither the success nor the easiness of escape that I had before, and I resolved to leave it off. But that resolution was confirmed soon after by the following accident. As my governess disguised me like a man, so she joined me with a man, a young fellow that was nimble enough at his business, and for about 3 weeks we did very well together. Our principal trade was watching shopkeepers' counters, and slipping off any kind of goods we could see carelessly laid anywhere, and we made several good bargains, as we called them, at this work. And as we kept always together, so we grew very intimate, yet he never knew that I was not a man, nay, though I several times went home with him to his lodgings, according as our business directed, and 4 or 5 times lay with him all night. But our design lay another way, and it was absolutely necessary to me to conceal my sex for him, as appeared afterwards. The circumstances of our living, coming in late and having such and such business to do as required that nobody should be trusted with the comings into our lodgings, were such as made it impossible to me to refuse lying with him unless I would have owned my sex, and, as it was, I effectually concealed myself. But his ill and my good fortune soon put an end to this life, which I must own I was sick of too on several other accounts. We had made several prizes in this new way of business, but the last would be extraordinary. There was a shop in a certain street which had a warehouse behind it that looked into another street, the house making the corner of the turning. Through the window of the warehouse we saw, lying on the counter or showboard, which was just below it, 5 pieces of silks, besides other stuffs, and though it was almost dark, yet the people, being busy in the foreshop with customers, had not had time to shut up those windows, or else had forgot it. This the young fellow was so overjoyed with that he could not restrain himself. It lay all within his reach, he said, and he swore violently to me that he would have it if he broke down the house for it. I dissuaded him a little, but saw there was no remedy, so he ran rashly upon it, slipped out a square of the sash window dexterously enough and without noise, and got out 4 pieces of the silks, and came with them towards me, but was immediately pursued with a terrible clutter and noise. We were standing together, indeed, but I had not taken any of the goods out of his hand, when I said to him hastily, "You're undone! Fly, for God's sake!" He ran like lightning, and I too, but the pursuit was hotter after him, because he had the goods, than after me. He dropped 2 of the pieces, which stopped them a little, but the crowd increased and pursued us both. They took him soon after, with the other 2 pieces upon him, and then the rest followed me. I ran for it, and got into my governess's house, whither some quick-eyed people followed me so warmly as to fix me there. They did not immediately knock at the door, by which I got time to throw off my disguise and dress me in my own clothes. Besides, when they came there, my governess, who had her tale ready, kept her door shut, and called out to them, and told them there was no man come in there. The people affirmed there did a man come in there, and swore they would break open the door. My governess, not at all surprised, spoke calmly to them, told them they should very freely come and search her house if they should bring a constable and let in none but such as the constable would admit, for it was unreasonable to let in a whole crowd. This they could not refuse, though they were a crowd. So a constable was fetched immediately, and she very freely opened the door. The constable kept the door, and the men he appointed searched the house, my governess going with them from room to room. When she came to my room, she called to me and said aloud, "Cousin, pray open the door. Here's some gentleman that must come and look into your room." I had a little girl with me, which was my governess's grandchild, as she called her, and I bade her open the door, and there I sat at work with a great litter of things about me, as if I had been at work all day, being myself quite undressed, with only nightclothes on my head and a loose morning gown wrapped about me. My governess made a kind of excuse for their disturbing me, telling me partly the occasion of it, and that she had no remedy but to open the doors to them and let them satisfy themselves, for all she could say to them would not satisfy them. I sat still and bid them search the room if they pleased, for if there was anybody in the house, I was sure they were not in my room, and as for the rest of the house, I had nothing to say to that. I did not understand what they looked for. Everything looked so innocent and so honest about me that they treated me civiller than I expected, but it was not till they had searched the room to a nicety, even under the bed, in the bed, and everywhere else where it was possible anything could be hid. When they had done this and could find nothing, they asked my pardon for troubling me, and went down. When they had thus searched the house from bottom to top, and then top to bottom, and could find nothing, they appeased the mob pretty well. But they carried my governess before the justice. 2 men swore that they saw the man whom they pursued go into her house. My governess rattled and made a great noise that her house should be insulted and that she should be used thus for nothing, that if a man did come in he might go out again presently for aught she knew, for she was ready to make oath that no man had been within her doors all that day as she knew of, and that was very true indeed. That it might be, indeed, that as she was above stairs, any fellow in a fright might find the door open and run in for shelter when he was pursued, but that she knew nothing of it, and if it had been so, he certainly went out again, perhaps at the other door, for she had another door into an alley, and so had made his escape and cheated them all. This was indeed probable enough, and the justice satisfied himself with giving her an oath that she had not received or admitted any man into her house to conceal him, or protect or hide him from justice. This oath she might justly take, and did so, and so she was dismissed. It is easy to judge what a fright I was in upon this occasion, and it was impossible for my governess ever to bring me to dress in that disguise again, for as I told her, I should certainly betray myself. My poor partner in this mischief was now in a bad case, for he was carried away before my Lord Mayor, and by his worship committed to Newgate, and the people that took him were so willing as well as able to prosecute him that they offered themselves to enter into reconnaissance to appear at the sessions and pursue the charge against him. However, he got his indictment deferred upon promise to discover his accomplices, and particularly the man that was concerned with him in his robbery. And he failed not to do his endeavour, for he gave in my name, whom he called Gabriel Spencer, which was the name I went by to him. And here appeared the wisdom of my concealing my name and sex from him, which, if he had ever known, I had been undone. He did all he could to discover this Gabriel Spencer. He described me, he discovered the place where he said I lodged, and, in a word, all the particulars that he could of my dwelling. But having concealed the main circumstances of my sex from him, I had a vast advantage, and he never could hear of me. He brought two or three families into trouble by his endeavouring to find me out, but they knew nothing of me, any more than that I had a fellow with me that they had seen, but knew nothing of. And as for my governess, though she was the means of his coming to me, yet it was done at second hand, and he knew nothing of her. This turned to his disadvantage, for having promised discoveries, but not being able to make it good, it was looked upon as trifling with the justice of the city, and he was the more fiercely pursued by the shopkeepers who took him. I was, however, terribly uneasy all this while, and that I might be quite out of the way, I went away from my governesses for a while, but not knowing whither to wander, I took a maidservant with me, and took the stagecoach to Dunstable, to my old landlord and landlady, where I had lived so handsomely with my Lancashire husband. Here I told her a formal story, that I expected my husband every day from Ireland, and that I had sent a letter to him that I would meet him at Dunstable at her house, and that he would certainly land, if the wind was fair, in a few days, so that I was come to spend a few days with him till he should come, for he was either come post or in the Westchester coach, I knew not which, but whichsoever it was, he would be sure to come to that house to meet me. My landlady was mighty glad to see me, and my landlord made such a stir with me that if I had been a princess I could not have been better used, and here I might have been welcome a month or two if I had thought fit. But my business was of another nature. I was very uneasy, though so well disguised that it was scarce possible to detect me, lest this fellow should somehow or other find me out, and though he could not charge me with this robbery, having persuaded him not to venture, and having also done nothing in it myself but run away, yet he might have charged me with other things, and have bought his own life at the expense of mine. This filled me with horrid apprehensions. I had no recourse, no friend, no confidant, but my old governess, and I knew no remedy but to put my life in her hands, and so I did, for I let her know where to send to me, and had several letters from her while I stayed here. Some of them almost scared me out of my wits, but at last she sent me the joyful news that he was hanged, which was the best news to me that I had heard a great while. I had stayed here 5 weeks, and lived very comfortably indeed, the secret anxiety of my mind excepted, but when I received this letter, I looked pleasantly again, and told my landlady that I had received a letter from my spouse in Ireland, that I had the good news of his being very well, but had the bad news that his business would not permit him to come away so soon as he expected, and so I was like to go back again without him. My landlady complimented me upon the good news, however, that I had heard he was well. "For I have observed, madam," said she, "you hadn't been so pleasant as you used to be. You have been over head and ears in care for him, I dare say," says the good woman. "'Tis easy to be seen there's an alteration in you for the better," says she. "Well, I am sorry the esquire can't come," says my landlord. "I should have been heartily glad to have seen him. But I hope, when you have certain news of his coming, you'll take a step hither again, madam," says he. "You shall be very welcome whenever you please to come." End of section 15. Section 16 of Moll Flanders by Daniel Defoe. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. Section 16. Moll Flanders. With all these fine compliments we parted, and I came merry enough to London, and found my governess as well pleased as I was. And now she told me she would never recommend any partner to me again, for she always found, she said, that I had the best luck when I ventured by myself. And so indeed I had, for I was seldom in any danger when I was by myself, or if I was, I got out of it with more dexterity than when I was entangled with the dull measures of other people, who had perhaps less forecast, and were more rash and impatient than I. For though I had as much courage to venture as any of them, yet I used more caution before I undertook a thing, and had more presence of mind when I was to bring myself off. I have often wondered, even at my own hardiness another way, that when all my companions were surprised and fell so suddenly into the hand of justice, and that I so narrowly escaped, yet I could not all this while enter into one serious resolution to leave off this trade, and especially considering that I was now very far from being poor, that the temptation of necessity, which is generally the introduction of all such wickedness, was now removed, for I had near £500 by me in ready money, on which I might have lived very well if I had thought fit to have retired. But I say, I had not so much as the least inclination to leave off. No, not so much as I had before when I had but £200 beforehand, and when I had no such frightful examples before my eyes as these were. From hence 'tis evident to me that when once we are hardened in crime, no fear can affect us, no example give us any warning. I had indeed one comrade whose fate went very near me for a good while, though I wore it off too in time. That case was indeed very unhappy. I had made a prize of a piece of very good damask in a mercer's shop, and went clear off myself, but had conveyed the piece to this companion of mine when we went out of the shop, and she went one way and I went another. We had not been long out of the shop, but the mercer missed his piece of stuff, and sent his messengers, one way and one another, and they presently seized her that had the piece, with the damask upon her. As for me, I had very luckily stepped into a house where there was a lace chamber, up one pair of stairs, and had the satisfaction, or the terror, indeed, of looking out of the window upon the noise they made, and seeing the poor creature dragged away in triumph to the justice, who immediately committed her to Newgate. I was careful to attempt nothing in the lace chamber, but tumbled their goods pretty much to spend time, then bought a few yards of edging and paid for it, and came away very sad-hearted indeed for the poor woman, who was in tribulation for what I only had stolen. Here again my old caution stood me in good stead, namely, that though I often robbed with these people, yet I never let them know who I was, or where I lodged, nor could they ever find out my lodging, though they often endeavoured to watch me do it. They all knew me by the name of Moll Flanders, even though some of them rather believed I was she than knew me to be so. My name was public among them indeed, but how to find me out they knew not, nor so much as how to guess at my quarters, whether they were at the east end of the town or the west, and this wariness was my safety upon all these occasions. I kept close a great while upon the occasion of this woman's disaster. I knew that if I should do anything that should miscarry and should be carried to prison, she would be there and ready to witness against me, and perhaps save her life at my expense. I considered that I began to be very well known by name at the Old Bailey, though they did not know my face, and that if I should fall into their hands, I should be treated as an old offender, and for this reason I was resolved to see what this poor creature's fate should be before I stirred abroad, though several times in her distress I conveyed money to her for her relief. At length she came to her trial. She pleaded she did not steal the thing, but that one Mrs. Flanders, as she heard her called, for she did not know her, gave the bundle to her after they came out of the shop, and bade her carry it home to her lodging. They asked her where this Mrs. Flanders was, but she could not produce her, neither could she give the least account of me, and the mercer's men, swearing positively that she was in the shop when the goods were stolen, that they immediately missed them, and pursued her, and found them upon her, thereupon the jury brought her in guilty. But the court, considering that she was not really the person that stole the goods, an inferior assistant, and that it was very possible she could not find out this Mrs. Flanders, meaning me, though it would save her life, which indeed was true, I say, considering all this, they allowed her to be transported, which was the utmost favour she could obtain, only that the court told her that if she could in the meantime produce the said Mrs. Flanders, they would intercede for her pardon. That is to say, if she could find me out and hand me, she should not be transported. This I took care to make impossible to her, and so she was shipped off in pursuance of her sentence a little while after. I must repeat it again, that the fate of this poor woman troubled me exceedingly, and I began to be very pensive, knowing that I was really the instrument of her disaster. but the preservation of my own life, which was so evidently in danger, took off all my tenderness, and seeing that she was not put to death, I was very easy at her transportation, because she was then out of the way of doing me any mischief, whatever should happen. The disaster of this woman was some months before that of the last recited story, and was indeed partly occasion of my governess proposing to dress me up in men's clothes, that I might go about unobserved, as indeed I did. But I was soon tired of that disguise, as I have said, for indeed it exposed me to too many difficulties. I was now easy as to all fear of witnesses against me, for all those that had either been concerned with me, or that knew me by the name of Moll Flanders, were either hanged or transported, and if I should have had the misfortune to be taken, I might call myself anything else as well as Moll Flanders, and no old sins could be placed into my account. So I began to run a tick again with the more freedom, and several successful adventures I made, though not such as I had made before. We had at that time another fire happened, not a great way off from the place where my governess lived, and I made an attempt there, as before, but as I was not soon enough before the crowd of people came in, and could not get to the house I aimed at, instead of a prize I got a mischief, which had almost put a period to my life and all my wicked doings together. For the fire, being very furious, and the people in a great fright in removing their goods and throwing them out of window, a wench from out of a window threw a feather bed just upon me. It is true, the bed being soft, it broke no bones, but as the weight was great and made greater by the fall, it beat me down and laid me dead for a while. Nor did the people concern themselves much to deliver me from it or to recover me at all, but I lay like one dead and neglected a good while, till somebody, going to remove the bed out of the way, helped me up. It was indeed a wonder the people in the house had not thrown other goods out after it, and which might have fallen upon it, and then I had been inevitably killed, but I was reserved for further afflictions. This accident, however, spoiled my market for that time, and I came home to my governess very much hurt and bruised and frighted to the last degree, and it was a good while before she could set me upon my feet again. It was now a merry time of the year, and Bartholomew Fair was begun. I had never made any walks that way, nor was the common part of the fair of much advantage to me, but I took a turn this year into the cloisters, and among the rest I fell into one of the raffling shops. It was a thing of no great consequence to me, nor did I expect to make much of it, but there came a gentleman extremely well-dressed and very rich, and 'tis frequent to talk to everybody in those shops. He singled me out, and was very particular with me. First he told me he would put in for me to raffle, and did so, and some small matter coming to his lot, he presented it to me. I think it was a feather muff. Then he continued to keep talking to me with a more than common appearance of respect, but still very civil and much like a gentleman. He held me in talk so long till at last he drew me out of the raffling place to the shop door and then to a walk in the cloisters, still talking of a thousand things cursorily without anything to the purpose. At last he told me that, without compliment, he was charmed with my company and asked me if I durst trust myself in a coach with him. He told me he was a man of honour, and would not offer anything to me unbecoming him as such. I seemed to decline it a while, but suffered myself to be importuned a little, and then yielded. I was at a loss in my thoughts to conclude at first what this gentleman designed, but I found afterwards that he had some drink in his head, and that he was not very unwilling to have some more. He carried me in the coach to the Spring Garden at Knightsbridge, where we walked in the gardens, and he treated me very handsomely, but I found he drank very freely. He pressed me also to drink, but I declined it. Hitherto he kept his word with me, and offered me nothing amiss. We came away in the coach again, and he brought me into the streets, and by this time it was near 10 o'clock at night, and he stopped the coach at a house where, it seems, he was acquainted, and where they made no scruple to show us upstairs into a room with a bed in it. At first I seemed to be unwilling to go up, but after a few words I yielded to that too, being willing to see the end of it, and in hope to make something of it at last. As for the bed, etc., I was not much concerned about that part. Here he began to be a little freer with me than he had promised, and I, by little and little, yielded to everything, so that, in a word, he did what he pleased with me. I need say no more. All this while he drank freely too, and about 1 in the morning we went into the coach again. The air and the shaking of the coach made the drink he had get more up into his head than it was before, and he grew uneasy in the coach, and was for acting over again what he had been doing before. But as I thought my game was now secure, I resisted him, and brought him to be a little still, which had not lasted 5 minutes before he fell asleep. I took this opportunity to search him to a nicety. I took a gold watch with a silk purse of gold, his fine full-bottom periwig and silver-fringed gloves, his sword and fine snuff-box, and gently opening the coach door, stood ready to jump out while the coach was going on. But the coach stopped in the narrow street beyond Temple Bar to let another coach pass. I got softly out, fastened the door again, and gave my gentleman and the coach the slip both together, and never heard more of them. This was an adventure indeed, unlooked for, and perfectly undesigned by me, though I was not so past the merry part of life as to forget how to behave when a fop so blinded by his appetite should not know an old woman from a young. I did not indeed look so old as I was by 10 or 12 years, yet I was not a young wench of 17, and it was easy enough to be distinguished. There is nothing so absurd, so surfeiting, so ridiculous, as a man heated by wine in his head and wicked gust in his inclination together. He is in the possession of two devils at once, and can no more govern himself by his reason than a mill can grind without water. His vice tramples upon all that was in him that had any good in it, if any such thing there was. Nay, his very sense is blinded by his own rage, and he acts absurdity even in his views, such as drinking more when he is drunk already, picking up a common woman without regard to what she is or who she is, whether sound or rotten, clean or unclean, whether ugly or handsome, whether old or young, and so blinded as not really to distinguish. Such a man is worse than a lunatic. Prompted by his vicious, corrupted head, he no more knows what he is doing than this wretch of mine knew when I picked his pocket of his watch and his purse of gold. These are the men of whom Solomon says, they go like an ox to the slaughter, till a dart strikes through their liver. An admirable description, by the way, of the foul disease, which is a poisonous, deadly contagion mingling with the blood, whose centre or foundation is in the liver, from whence, by the swift circulation of the whole mass, that dreadful nauseous plague strikes immediately through his liver, and his spirits are infected, his vitals stabbed through as with a dart. It is true this poor unguarded wretch was in no danger from me, though I was greatly apprehensive at first of what danger I might be in from him. But he was really to be pitied in one respect, that he seemed to be a good sort of man in himself, a gentleman that had no harm in his design, a man of sense and of a fine behaviour, a comely, handsome person, a sober, solid countenance, a charming, beautiful face, and everything that could be agreeable. Only had, unhappily, had some drink the night before, had not been in bed, as he told me when we were together, was hot, and his blood fired with wine, and in that condition his reason, as it were asleep, had given him up. As for me, my business was his money, and what I could make of him, and after that, if I could have found out any way to have done it, I would have sent him safe home to his house and to his family, for 'twas 10 to 1, but he had an honest, virtuous wife and innocent children that were anxious for his safety, and would have been glad to have gotten him home, and have taken care of him till he was restored to himself. And then, with what shame and regret would he look back upon himself! How would he reproach himself with associating himself with a whore, picked up in the worst of all holes, the cloister, among the dirt and filth of all the town? How would he be trembling for fear he had got the pox, for fear a dart had struck through his liver, and hate himself every time he looked back upon the madness and brutality of his debauch? How would he, if he had any principles of honour, as I verily believe he had, I say, how would he abhor the thought of giving any ill distemper, if he had it, as for aught he knew he might, to his modest and virtuous wife, and thereby sowing the contagion in the life-blood of his posterity? Would such gentlemen but consider the contemptible thoughts which the very women they are concerned with in such cases as these have of them, it would be a surfeit to them. As I said above, they value not the pleasure, They are raised by no inclination to the man. The passive jade thinks of no pleasure but the money, and when he is, as it were, drunk in the ecstasies of his wicked pleasure, her hands are in his pockets, searching for what she can find there, and of which he can no more be sensible in the moment of his folly than he can forethink of it when he goes about it. I knew a woman that was so dexterous with a fellow, who indeed deserved no better usage, that while he was busy with her another way, conveyed his purse with 20 guineas in it out of his fob pocket, where he had put it for fear of her, and put another purse with gilded counters in it into the room of it. After he had done, he says to her, "Now, ain't you picked my pocket?" She jested with him and told him she supposed he had not much to lose. He put his hand to his fob, and with his fingers felt that his purse was there, which fully satisfied him, and so she brought off his money. And this was a trade with her. She kept a sham gold watch, that is, a watch of silver gilt, and a purse of counters in her pocket, to be ready on all such occasions, and I doubt not practised it with success. I came home with this last booty to my governess, and really, when I told her the story, it so affected her that she was hardly able to forbear tears to know how such a gentleman ran a daily risk of being undone every time a glass of wine got into his head. But as to the purchase I got, and how entirely I stripped him, she told me it pleased her wonderfully. "Nay, child," says she, "the usage may, for aught I know, do more to reform him than all the sermons that ever he will hear in his life." And if the remainder of the story be true, so it did. I found the next day she was wonderful inquisitive about this gentleman. The description I had given her of him, his dress, his person, his face, everything concurred to make her think of a gentleman whose character she knew, and family too. She mused a while, and I, going still on with the particulars, she starts up. Says she, "I'll lay £100, I know the gentleman." "I am sorry you do," says I, "for I would not have him exposed on any account in the world. He has had injury enough already by me, and I would not be instrumental to do him any more." "No, no," says she, "I will do him no injury, I assure you. But you may let me satisfy my curiosity a little, for if it is he, I warrant you I find it out." I was a little startled at that, and told her, with an apparent concern in my face, that by the same rule he might find me out, and then I was undone. She returned warmly, "Why do you think I will betray you, child?" "No, no," says she, "not for all he is worth in the world. I have kept your counsel in worse things than these. Sure you may trust me in this." So I said no more at that time. She laid her scheme another way, and without acquainting me of it, but she was resolved to find it out, if possible. So she goes to a certain friend of hers who was acquainted in the family that she guessed at, and told her friend she had some extraordinary business with such a gentleman, who, by the way, was no less than a baronet and of a very good family, and that she knew not how to come at him without somebody to introduce her. Her friend promised her very readily to do it, and accordingly goes to the house to see if the gentleman was in town. The next day she comes to my governess and tells me that Sir Blank was at home, but that he had met with a disaster and was very ill, and there was no speaking with him. "What disaster?" says my governess hastily, as if she was surprised at it. "Why," says her friend, "he had been at Hampstead to visit a gentleman of his acquaintance, and as he came back again he was set upon and robbed, and having got a little drink too, as they suppose, the rogues abused him, and he is very ill." "Robbed," says my governess, "and what did they take from him?" "Why," says her friend, "they took his gold watch and his gold snuff-box, his fine periwig, and what money he had in his pocket, which was considerable, to be sure, for Sir Blank never goes without a purse of guineas about him." "Pshaw," says my old governess, jeering, "I warrant you he's got drunk now and got a whore, and she has picked his pocket, and so he comes home to his wife and tells her he has been robbed. That's an old sham. 1,000 such tricks are put upon the poor women every day." "Fie," says her friend, "I find you don't know Sir Blank. Why, he is as civil a gentleman. There is not a finer man, nor a soberer, graver, modester person in the whole city. He abhors such things. There's nobody that knows him will think such a thing of him." "Well, well," says my governess, "that's none of my business. If it was, I warrant, I should find there was something of that kind in it. Your modest men, in common opinion, are sometimes no better than other people, only they keep a better character, or, if you please, are better hypocrites." No, no, sir, it's a friend. I can assure you Sir Blank is no hypocrite. He is really an honest, sober gentleman, and he has certainly been robbed. Nay, says my governess, it may be he has. It is no business of mine, I tell you. I only want to speak with him. My business is of another nature. But, says her friend, let your business be of what nature it will. You cannot see him yet, for he is not fit to be seen, for he is very ill and bruised very much. Aye, says my governess, nay, then he has fallen into bad hands, to be sure. And then she asks gravely, pray, where is he bruised? Why, in the head, says her friend, and one of his hands, and his face, for they used him barbarously. Poor gentleman, says my governess, I must wait then till he recovers, and adds, I hope it will not be long, for I want very much to speak with him. Away she comes to me and tells me this story. I have found out your fine gentleman, and a fine gentleman he was, says he, but mercy on him, he is in a sad pickle now. I wonder what the devil you have done to him. Why, you have almost killed him. I looked at her with disorder enough. I killed him, says I. You must mistake the person. I am sure I did nothing to him. He was very well when I left him, said I, only drunk and fast asleep. I know nothing of that, says she, but he is in a sad pickle now. And so she told me all that her friend had said to her. Well then, says I, he fell into bad hands after I left him, for I am sure I left him safe enough. About 10 days after, or a little more, my governess goes again to her friend to introduce her to this gentleman. She had inquired other ways in the meantime, and found that he was about again, if not abroad again, so she got leave to speak with him. She was a woman of an admirable address, and wanted nobody to introduce her. She told her tale much better than I should be able to tell it for her, for she was a mistress of her tongue, as I have said already. She told him that she came, though a stranger, with a single design of doing him a service, and he should find she had no other end in it. That as she came purely on so friendly an account, she begged promise from him that if he did not accept what she should officiously propose, he would not take it ill that she meddled with what was not her business. She assured him that as what she had to say was a secret that belonged to him only, so whether he accepted her offer or not, it should remain a secret to all the world, unless he exposed it himself. Nor should his refusing her service in it make her so little show her respect as to do him the least injury, so that he should be entirely at liberty to act as he thought fit. He looked very shy at first, and said he knew nothing that related to him that required much secrecy, that he had never done any man any wrong, and cared not what anybody might say of him, that it was no part of his character to be unjust to anybody, nor could he imagine in what any man could render him any service, but that if it was so disinterested a service as she said, he could not take it ill from any one that they should endeavour to serve him, and so, as it were, left her a liberty either to tell him or not to tell, as she thought fit. She found him so perfectly indifferent that she was almost afraid to enter into the point with him. But, however, after some other circumlocutions, she told him that by a strange and unaccountable accident she came to have a particular knowledge of the late unhappy adventure he had fallen into, and that in such a matter there was nobody in the world but herself and him that were acquainted with it, no, not the very person that was with him. He looked a little angrily at first. "What adventure?" said he. "Why," said she, "of your being robbed, coming from Hampstead, sir, I should say," says she. "Be not surprised, sir," says she, "that I am able to tell you every step you took that day, from the cloister in Smithfield to the spring garden at Knightsbridge, and thence to the blank in the Strand, and how you were left to sleep in the coach afterwards. I say, let not this surprise you, for, sir, I do not come to make a booty of you. I ask nothing of you, and I assure you the woman that was with you knows nothing who you are, and never shall. And yet, perhaps, I may serve you further still, for I did not come barely to let you know that I was informed of these things, as if I wanted a bribe to conceal them. Assure yourself, sir," said she, "that whatever you think fit to do or say to me, it shall be all as secret as it is, as much as if I were in my grave." He was astonished at her discourse, and said gravely to her, "Madam, you are a stranger to me, but it is very unfortunate that you should be let into the secret of the worst action of my life, and a thing that I am so justly ashamed of, that the only satisfaction of it to me was, that I thought it was known only to God and my own conscience." "Pray, sir," says she, "do not reckon the discovery of it to me to be any part of your misfortune. It was a thing, I believe, you were surprised into, and perhaps the woman used some art to prompt you to it. However, you will never find any just cause, said she, to repent that I came to hear of it, nor can your own mouth be more silent in it than I have been, and ever shall be. Well, says he, but let me do some justice to the woman too. Whoever she is, I do assure you, she prompted me to nothing, but rather declined me. It was my own folly and madness that brought me into it all, aye, and brought her into it too. I must give her her due so far. As to what she took from me, I could expect no less from her in the condition I was in, and to this hour I know not whether she robbed me or the coachman. If she did it, I forgive her, and I think all gentlemen that do so should be used in the same manner, but I am more concerned for some other things than I am for all that she took from me. My governess now began to come into the whole matter, and he opened himself freely to her. First, she said to him, in answer to what he had said about me, I am glad, sir, you are so just to the person that you were with. I assure you she is a gentlewoman and no woman of the town, and however you prevailed with her so far as you did, I am sure 'tis not her practice. You ran a great venture indeed, sir, but if that be any part of your care, I am persuaded you may be perfectly easy, for I dare assure you no man has touched her before you since her husband, and he has been dead now almost 8 years. It appeared that this was his grievance, and that he was in a very great fright about it. However, when my governess said this to him, he appeared very well pleased, and said, Well, madam, to be plain with you, if I was satisfied of that, I should not so much value what I lost, for as to that, the temptation was great, and perhaps she was poor and wanted it. If she had not been poor, sir, says my governess, I assure you she would never have yielded to you. And as her poverty first prevailed with her to let you do as you did, so the same poverty prevailed with her to pay herself at last when she saw you were in such a condition that if she had not done it, perhaps the next coachman might have done it. Well, says he, much good may it do her. I say again, all the gentlemen that do so ought to be used in the same manner, and then they would be cautious of themselves. I have no more concern about it but on the score which you hinted at before, madam. Here he entered into some freedoms with her on the subject of what passed between us, which are not so proper for a woman to write, and the great terror that was upon his mind with relation to his wife, for fear he should have received any injury from me, and should communicate it farther, and asked her at last if she could not procure him an opportunity to speak with me. My governess gave him further assurances of my being a woman clear from any such thing, and that he was as entirely safe in that respect as he was with his own lady. But as for seeing me, she said it might be of dangerous consequence, but, however, that she would talk with me and let him know my answer, using at the same time some arguments to persuade him not to desire it, and that it could be of no service to him, seeing she hoped he had no desire to renew a correspondence with me, and that on my account it was a kind of putting my life into his hands. He told her he had a great desire to see me, that he would give her any assurances that were in his power, not to take any advantage of me, and that in the first place he would give me a general release from all demands of any kind. She insisted how it might tend to her further divulging the secret, and might in the end be injurious to him, entreating him not to press for it. So at length he desisted. They had some discourse upon the subject of the things he had lost, and he seemed to be very desirous of his gold watch, and told her that if she could procure that for him, he would willingly give as much for it as it was worth. She told him she would endeavour to procure it for him, and leave the valuing of it to himself. Accordingly, the next day she carried the watch, and he gave her 30 guineas for it, which was more than I should have been able to make of it, though it seems it cost much more. He spoke something of his periwig, which it seems cost him 60 guineas, and his snuff-box, and in a few days more she carried them too, which obliged him very much, and he gave her 30 more. The next day I sent him his fine sword and cane gratis, and demanded nothing of him, but I had no mind to see him, unless it had been so that he might be satisfied I knew who he was, which he was not willing to. Then he entered into a long talk with her of the manner how she came to know all this matter. She formed a long tale of that part, how she had it from one that I had told the whole story to, and that was to help me dispose of the goods, and this confidant brought the things to her, she being by profession a pawnbroker, and she hearing of his worship's disaster, guessed at the thing in general. that having gotten the things into her hands, she had resolved to come and try as she had done. She then gave him repeated assurances that it should never go out of her mouth, and though she knew the woman very well, yet she had not let her know, meaning me, anything of it, that is to say, who the person was, which, by the way, was false. But, however, it was not to his damage, for I never opened my mouth of it to anybody. I had a great many thoughts in my head about my seeing him again, and was often sorry that I had refused it. I was persuaded that if I had seen him, and let him know that I knew him, I should have made some advantage of him, and perhaps have had some maintenance from him. And though it was a life wicked enough, yet it was not so full of danger as this I was engaged in. However, those thoughts wore off, and I declined seeing him again for that time. But my governess saw him often, and he was very kind to her, giving her something almost every time he saw her. One time in particular she found him very merry, and as she thought he had some wine in his head, and he pressed her again very earnestly to let him see that woman that, as he said, had bewitched him so that night, my governess, who was from the beginning for my seeing him, told him he was so desirous of it that she could almost yield to it if she could prevail upon me, adding that if he would please to come to her house in the evening, she would endeavour it, upon his repeated assurances of forgetting what was past. Accordingly, she came to me, and told me all the discourse. In short, she soon biased me to consent, in a case which I had some regret in my mind for declining before. So I prepared to see him. I dressed me to all the advantage possible, I assure you, and for the first time I used a little art. I say for the first time, for I had never yielded to the baseness of paint before, having always had vanity enough to believe I had no need of it. At the hour appointed he came, and, as she observed before, so it was plain still that he had been drinking, though very far from what we call being in drink. He appeared exceedingly pleased to see me, and entered into a long discourse with me upon the old affair. I begged his pardon very often for my share in it, protested I had not any such design when first I met him, that I had not gone out with him, but that I took him for a very civil gentleman, and that he made me so many promises of offering no uncivility to me. He alleged the wine he drank, and that he scarce knew what he did, and that if it had not been so, I should never have let him take the freedom with me that he had done. He protested to me that he never touched any woman but me since he was married to his wife, and it was a surprise upon him, complimented me upon being so particularly agreeable to him and the like, and talked so much of that kind till I found he had talked himself almost into a temper to do the same thing over again. But I took him up short. I protested I had never suffered any man to touch me since my husband died, which was near 8 years. He said he believed it to be so, truly, and added that Madam had intimated as much to him, and that it was his opinion of that part which made his desire to see me again, and that since he had once broke in upon his virtue with me, and found no ill consequences, he could be safe in venturing there again. And so, in short, it went on to what I expected, and to what will not bear relating. My old governess had foreseen it as well as I, and therefore led him into a room which had not a bed in it, and yet had a chamber within it which had a bed, whither we withdrew for the rest of the night. And in short, after some time being together, he went to bed, and lay there all night. I withdrew, but came again undressed in the morning before it was day, and lay with him the rest of the time. Thus, you see, having committed a crime once is a sad handle to the committing of it again, whereas all the regret and reflection wear off when the temptation renews itself. Had I not yielded to see him again, the corrupt desire in him had worn off, and 'tis very probable he had never fallen into it with anybody else, as I really believe he had not done before. When he went away, I told him I hoped he was satisfied he had not been robbed again. He told me he was satisfied in that point, and could trust me again, and putting his hand in his pocket, gave me 5 guineas, which was the first money I had gained that way for many years. I had several visits of the like kind from him, but he never came into a settled way of maintenance, which was what I would have been best pleased with. Once, indeed, he asked me how I did to live. I answered him pretty quick that I assured him I had never taken that course that I took with him, but that indeed I worked at my needle, and could just maintain myself, that sometimes it was as much as I was able to do, and I shifted hard enough. He seemed to reflect upon himself that he should be the first person to lead me into that, which he assured me he never intended to do himself, and it touched him a little, he said, that he should be the cause of his own sin, and mine too. He would often make just reflection also upon the crime itself, and upon the particular circumstances of it with respect to himself, how wine introduced the inclinations, how the devil led him to the place, and found out an object to tempt him, and he made the moral always himself. When these thoughts were upon him, he would go away, and perhaps not come again in a month's time or longer. But then, as the serious part wore off, the lewd part would wear in, and then he came prepared for the wicked part. Thus we lived for some time. Though he did not keep, as they call it, yet he never failed doing things that were handsome, and sufficient to maintain me without working, and which was better, without following my old trade. But this affair had its end too, for after about a year I found that he did not come so often as usual, and at last he left it off altogether, without any dislike to bidding adieu. And so there was an end of that short scene of life, which added no great store to me, only to make more work for repentance. However, during this interval I confined myself pretty much at home. At least, being thus provided for, I made no adventures, no, not for a quarter of a year after he left me. But then, finding the fund fail, and being loath to spend upon the main stock, I began to think of my old trade, and to look abroad into the street again, and my first step was lucky enough. End of section 16. Section 17 of Moll Flanders by Daniel Defoe. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. Section 17. Moll Flanders. I had dressed myself up in a very mean habit, for as I had several shapes to appear in, I was now in an ordinary stuff gown, a blue apron, and a straw hat, and I placed myself at the door of the Three Cups Inn in St. John Street. There were several carriers used the inn, and the stagecoaches for Barnet, for Tottridge, and other towns that way stood always in the street in the evening when they prepared to set out, so that I was ready for anything that offered, for either one or other. The meaning was this. People come frequently with bundles and small parcels to those inns, and call for such carriers or coaches as they want to carry them into the country, and there generally attend women, porters' wives, or daughters, ready to take in such things for their respective people that employ them. It happened very oddly that I was standing at the inn gate, and a woman that had stood there before, and which was the porter's wife belonging to the Barnet stagecoach, having observed me, asked if I waited for any of the coaches. I told her yes, I waited for my mistress that was coming to go to Barnet. She asked me who was my mistress, and I told her any madam's name that came next me, but as it seemed I happened upon a name, a family of which name lived at Hadley, just beyond Barnet. I said no more to her, or she to me, a good while. But by and by, somebody calling her at a door a little way off, she desired me that if anybody called for the Barnet coach, I would step and call her at the house, which it seems was an alehouse. I said yes, very readily, and away she went. She was no sooner gone, but comes a wench and a child, puffing and sweating, and asks for the Barnet coach. I answered presently, "Here." "Do you belong to the Barnet coach?" says she. "Yes, sweetheart," said I. "What do you want?" "I want room for two passengers," says she. "Where are they, sweetheart?" said I. "Here's this girl. Pray let her go into the coach," says she, "and I'll go and fetch my mistress." "Make haste then, sweetheart," says I, "for we may be full else." The maid had a great bundle under her arm, so she put the child into the coach, and I said, "You had best put your bundle into the coach too." "No," says she, "I am afraid somebody should slip it away from the child." "Give it me then," said I, "and I'll take care of it." "Do then," says she, "and be sure you take of it." "I'll answer for it," said I, "if it were for £20 value." "There, take it then," says she, and away she goes. As soon as I had got the bundle and the maid was out of sight, I goes on towards the alehouse where the porter's wife was, so that if I had met her, I had then only been going to give her the bundle and to call her to her business, as if I were going away and could stay no longer. But as I did not meet her, I walked away, and turning into Charterhouse Lane, then crossed into Bartholomew Close, so into Little Britain, and through the Blue Coat Hospital into Newgate Street. To prevent my being known, I pulled off my blue apron and wrapped the bundle in it, which before was made up in a piece of painted calico, and very remarkable. I also wrapped up my straw hat in it, and so put the bundle upon my head, and it was very well that I did thus, for coming through the Blue Coat Hospital, who should I meet but the wench that had given me the bundle to hold? It seemed she was going with her mistress, whom she had gone to fetch, to the Barnet coaches. I saw she was in haste, and I had no business to stop her, so away she went, and I brought my bundle safe home to my governess. There was no money, nor plate or jewels in the bundle, but a very good suit of Indian damask, a gown and a petticoat, a laced head and ruffles of very good Flanders lace, and some linen and other things, such as I knew very well the value of. This was not indeed my own invention, but was given me by one that had practised it with success, and my governess liked it extremely, and indeed I tried it again several times, though never twice near the same place. For the next time I tried it in Whitechapel, just by the corner of Petticoat Lane, where the coaches stand that go out to Stratford and Bow and that side of the country, and another time at the Flying Horse, without Bishopgate, where the Cheston coaches then lay. And I had always the good luck to come off with some booty. Another time I placed myself at a warehouse by the waterside, where the coasting vessels from the north come, such as from Newcastle upon Tyne, Sunderland, and other places. Here, the warehouses being shut, comes a young fellow with a letter, and he wanted a box and a hamper that was come from Newcastle upon Tyne. I asked him if he had the marks of it, so he shows me the letter, by virtue of which he was to ask for it, and which gave an account of the contents, the box being full of linen and the hamper full of glassware. I read the letter, and took care to see the name and the marks, the name of the person that sent the goods, the name of the person that they were sent to. Then I bade the messenger come in the morning, for that the warehouse keepers would not be there any more that night. Away I went, and getting materials in a public house, I wrote a letter to Mr. John Richardson of Newcastle, to his dear cousin Jemmy Cole in London, with an account that he was sent by such a vessel, for I remembered all the particulars to her title, so many pieces of huckaback linen, so many ells of Dutch Holland and the like, in a box, and a hamper of flint glasses from Mr. Hensel's glasshouse, and that the box was marked IC, number 1, and the hamper was directed by a label on the cording. About an hour after, I came to the warehouse, found the warehouse keeper, and had the goods delivered me without any scruple, the value of the linen being about £22. I could fill up this whole discourse with a variety of such adventures which daily invention directed to, and which I managed with the utmost dexterity, and always with success. At length, as when does the pitcher come safe home that goes so very often to the well, I fell into some small broils, which, though they could not affect me fatally, yet made me known, which was the worst thing next to being found guilty that could befall me. I had taken up the disguise of a widow's dress. It was without any real design in view, but only waiting for anything that might offer, as I often did. It happened that while I was going along the street in Covent Garden, there was a great cry of, "Stop thief! Stop thief!" Some artist had, it seems, put a trick upon a shopkeeper, and being pursued, some of them fled one way and some another, and one of them was, they said, dressed up in widow's weeds, upon which the mob gathered about me, and some said I was the person, others said no. Immediately came the mercer's journeyman, and he swore aloud I was the person, and so seized on me. However, when I was brought back by the mob to the mercer's shop, the master of the house said freely that I was not the woman that was in his shop, and would have let me go immediately, but another fellow said gravely, "Pray stay till Mr. Blank," meaning the journeyman, "comes back, for he knows her." So they kept me by force near half an hour. They had called a constable, and he stood in the shop as my jailer, and in talking with the constable I inquired where he lived and what trade he was in. The man, not apprehending in the least what happened afterwards, readily told me his name and trade and where he lived, and told me as a jest that I might be sure to hear of his name when I came to the Old Bailey. Some of the servants likewise used me saucily, and had much ado to keep their hands off me. The master indeed was civiller to me than they, but he would not yet let me go, though he owned he could not say I was in his shop before. I began to be a little surly with him, and told him I hoped he would not take it ill if I made myself amends upon him in a more legal way another time, and desired I might send for friends to see me have right done me. No, he said, he could give no such liberty. I might ask it when I came before the Justice of Peace, and seeing I threatened him, he would take care of me in the meantime, and would lodge me safe in Newgate. I told him it was his time now, but it would be mine by and by, and governed my passion as well as I was able. However, I spoke to the constable to call me a porter, which he did, and then I called for pen, ink, and paper, but they would let me have none. I asked the porter his name and where he lived, and the poor man told me very willingly. I bade him observe and remember how I was treated there, that he saw I was detained there by force. I told him I should want his evidence in another place, and it should not be the worse for him to speak. The porter said he would serve me with all his heart. "But, madam," says he, "let me hear them refuse to let you go, then I may be able to speak the plainer." With that I spoke aloud to the master of the shop, and said, "Sir, you know in your own conscience that I am not the person you look for, and that I was not in your shop before. Therefore I demand that you detain me here no longer, or tell me the reason of your stopping me." The fellow grew surlier upon this than before, and said he would do neither till he thought fit. "Very well," said I to the constable and to the porter. "You will be pleased to remember this gentleman another time." The porter said, "Yes, madam," and the constable began not to like it, and would have persuaded the mercer to dismiss me and let me go, since, as he said, he owned I was not the person. "Good sir," says the mercer to him tauntingly, "are you a justice of peace or a constable? I charged you with her. Pray do you do your duty." The constable told him, a little moved, but very handsomely, "I know my duty and what I am, sir. I doubt you hardly know what you are doing." They had some other hard words, and in the meantime the journeyman, impudent and unmanly to the last degree, used me barbarously, and one of them, the same that first seized upon me, pretended he would search me, and began to lay hands on me. I spit in his face, called out to the constable, and bade him to take notice of my usage. "And pray, Mr. Constable," said I, "ask that villain's name," pointing to the man. The constable reproved him decently, told him that he did not know what he did, for he knew that his master acknowledged I was not the person that was in his shop. "And," says the constable, "I am afraid your master is bringing himself, and me too, into trouble, if this gentlewoman comes to prove who she is and where she was, and it appears that she is not the woman you pretend to." "Damn her," says the fellow again with an impudent heart and face. "She is the lady, you may depend upon it. I'll swear she is the same body that was in the shop, and that I gave the pieces of satin that is lost into her own hand. You shall hear more of it when Mr. William and Mr. Anthony," these were other journeymen, "come back. They will know her again as well as I." Just as the insolent rogue was talking thus to the constable, comes back Mr. William and Mr. Anthony, as he called them, and a great rabble with them, bringing along with them the true widow that I was pretended to be. And they came sweating and blowing into the shop, and with a great deal of triumph dragging the poor creature in the most butcherly manner up towards their master, who was in the back of the shop, and cried out aloud, "Here's the widow, sir! We have catched her at last!" "What do you mean by that?" says the master. "Why, we have her already. There she sits," says he, "and Mr. Blank," says he, "can swear that is she." The other man, whom they called Mr. Anthony, replied, "Mr. Blank may say what he will and swear what he will, but this is the woman, and there's the remnant of the satin she stole. I took it out of her clothes with my own hand." I sat still now and began to take a better heart, but smiled and said nothing. The master looked pale. The constable turned about and looked at me. "Let him alone, Mr. Constable," said I. "Let him go on." The case was plain and could not be denied, so the constable was charged with the right thief, and the mercer told me very civilly he was sorry for the mistake, and hoped I would not take it ill, that they had so many things of this nature put upon them every day that they could not be blamed for being very sharp in doing themselves justice. "Not take it ill, sir," said I. "How can I take it well? If you had dismissed me when your insolent fellow seized on me in the street and brought me to you, and when you yourself acknowledged I was not the person, I would have put it by and not taken it ill, because of the many ill things I believe you have put upon you daily. But your treatment of me since has been insufferable, and especially that of your servant. I must and will have reparation for that." Then he began to parley with me, said he would make me any reasonable satisfaction, and would fain have had me tell him what it was I expected. I told him that I should not be my own judge. The law should decide it for me, and as I was to be carried before a magistrate, I should let him hear there what I had to say. He told me there was no occasion to go before the justice now. I was at liberty to go where I pleased, and so, calling to the constable, told him he might let me go, for I was discharged. the constable said calmly to him. "Sir, you asked me just now if I knew whether I was constable or justice, and bade me do my duty, and charged me with this gentlewoman as a prisoner. Now, sir, I find you do not understand what is my duty, for you would make me a justice indeed, but I must tell you it is not in my power. I may keep a prisoner when I am charged with him, but 'tis the law and the magistrate alone that can discharge that prisoner. Therefore, 'tis a mistake, sir. I must carry her before a justice now, whether you think well of it or not." The mercer was very high with the constable at first, but the constable, happening to be not a hired officer, but a good substantial kind of man, I think he was a corn handler, and a man of good sense, stood to his business, would not discharge me without going to a justice of the peace, and I insisted upon it too. When the mercer saw that, "Well," says he to the constable, "you may carry her where you please. I have nothing to say to her." "But, sir," says the constable, "you will go with us, I hope, for 'tis you that charged me with her." "No, not I," says the mercer. "I tell you I have nothing to say to her." "But pray, sir, do," says the constable. "I desire it of you for your own sake, for the justice can do nothing without you." "Prithee, fellow," says the mercer, "go about your business. I tell you I have nothing to say to the gentlewoman. I charge you, in the king's name, to dismiss her." "Sir," says the constable, "I find you don't know what it is to be a constable. I beg of you, don't oblige me to be rude to you." "I think I need not. You are rude enough already," says the mercer. "No, sir," says the constable, "I am not rude. You have broken the peace in bringing an honest woman out of the street where she was about her lawful occasion, confining her in your shop and ill-using her here by your servants, and now can you say I am rude to you? I think I am civil to you in not commanding or charging you in the king's name to go with me, and charging every man I see that passes your door to aid and assist me in carrying you by force. This you cannot but know I have power to do, and yet I forbear it, and once more entreat you to go with me." Well, he would not for all this, and gave the constable ill language. However, the constable kept his temper and would not be provoked, and then I put in and said, "Come, Mr. Constable, let him alone. I shall find way enough to fetch him before a magistrate. I don't fear that. But there's the fellow," said I. "He was the man that seized on me as I was innocently going along the street, and you are a witness of the violence with me since. Give me leave to charge you with him, and carry him before the justice." "Yes, madam," says the constable, and turning to the fellow, "Come, young gentleman," says he to the journeyman, "you must go along with me. I hope you are not above the constable's power, though your master is." The fellow looked like a condemned thief, and hung back, then looked at his master as if he could help him. And he, like a fool, encouraged the fellow to be rude, and he truly resisted the constable, and pushed him back with a good force when he went to lay hold on him, at which the constable knocked him down, and called out for help, and immediately the shop was filled with people, and the constable seized the master and man, and all his servants. This first ill consequence of this fray was that the woman they had taken, who was really the thief, made off and got clear away in the crowd, and two others that they had stopped also. Whether they were really guilty or not, that I can say nothing to. By this time some of his neighbours having come in, and upon inquiry, seeing how things went, had endeavoured to bring the hot-brained mercer to his senses, and he began to be convinced that he was in the wrong, and so at length we went all very quietly before the justice, with a mob of about 500 people at our heels, and all the way I went I could hear the people ask what was the matter, and other reply and say, "A mercer had stopped a gentlewoman instead of a thief, and had afterwards taken the thief, for now the gentlewoman had taken the mercer, and was carrying him before the justice." This pleased the people strangely, and made the crowd increase, and they cried out as they went, "Which is the rogue? Which is the mercer?" and especially the women. Then when they saw him, they cried out, "That's he! That's he!" and every now and then came a good dab of dirt at him, and thus we marched a good while, till the mercer thought fit to desire the constable to call a coach to protect himself from the rabble. So he rode the rest of the way, the constable and I, and the mercer and his man. When we came to the justice, which was an ancient gentleman in Bloomsbury, the constable giving first a summary account of the matter, the justice bade me speak and tell me what I had to say. At first he asked my name, which I was very loath to give, but there was no remedy. So I told him my name was Mary Flanders, that I was a widow, my husband being a sea captain, died on a voyage to Virginia, and some other circumstances I told which he could never contradict, and that I lodged at present in town with such a person, naming my governess, but that I was preparing to go over to America, where my husband's effects lay, and that I was going that day to buy some clothes to put myself into second mourning, but had not yet been in any shop, when that fellow, pointing to the mercer's journeyman, came rushing upon me with such fury as very much frightened me, and carried me back to his master's shop, where, though his master acknowledged I was not the person, yet he would not dismiss me, but charged a constable with me. Then I proceeded to tell how the journeymen treated me, how they would not suffer me to send for any of my friends, how afterwards they found the real thief, and took the very goods they had lost upon her, and all the particulars as before. Then the constable related his case, his dialogue with the mercer about discharging me, and at last his servants refusing to go with him when he had charged him with him, and his master encouraging him to do so, and at last his striking the constable and the like, all as I have told it already. The justice then heard the mercer and his man. The mercer, indeed, made a long harangue of the great loss they have daily by lifters and thieves, that it was easy for them to mistake, and that when he found it he would have dismissed me, etc., as above. As to the journeyman, he had very little to say, but that he pretended other of the servants told him that I was really the person. Upon the whole, the justice first of all told me, very courteously, I was discharged, that he was very sorry that the mercer's man should, in his eager pursuit, have so little discretion as to take up an innocent person for a guilty person, that if he had not been so unjust as to detain me afterward, he believed I would have forgiven the first affront. That, however, it was not in his power to award me any reparations for anything other than by openly reproving them, which he should do, but he supposed I would apply to such methods as the law directed. In the meantime, he would bind him over. But as to the breach of the peace committed by the journeyman, he told me he should give me some satisfaction for that, for he should commit him to Newgate for assaulting the constable, and for assaulting me also. Accordingly, he sent the fellow to Newgate for that assault, and his master gave bail, and so we came away. But I had the satisfaction of seeing the mob wait upon them both as they came out, hallooing and throwing stones and dirt at the coaches they rode in. And so I came home to my governess. After this hustle, coming home and telling my governess the story, she falls a-laughing at me. "Why are you merry?" says I. "The story has not so much laughing room in it as you imagine. I am sure I have had a great deal of hurry and fright, too, with a pack of ugly rogues." "Laugh," says my governess. "I laugh, child, to see what a lucky creature you are. Why, this job will be the best bargain to you that ever you made in your life, if you manage it well. I warrant you," says she, "you shall make the mercer pay you £500 for damages, besides what you shall get out of the journeyman." I had other thoughts of the matter than she had, and especially because I had given in my name to the Justice of Peace, and I knew that my name was so well known among the people at Hicks Hall, the Old Bailey, and such places, that if this came to be tried openly, and my name came to be inquired into, no court would have given much damages for the reputation of a person of such a character. However, I was obliged to begin a prosecution in form, and accordingly my governess found me out a very creditable sort of a man to manage it, being an attorney of very good business and of a good reputation, and she was certainly in the right of this, for had she employed a pettifogging hedge solicitor, or a man not known and not in good reputation, I should have brought it to but little. I met this attorney and gave him all the particulars at large as they are recited above, and he assured me it was a case, as he said, that would very well support itself, and that he did not question but that a jury would give very considerable damages on such an occasion. So, taking his full instructions, he began the prosecution, and the mercer, being arrested, gave bail. A few days after his giving bail, he comes with his attorney to my attorney to let him know that he desired to accommodate the matter, that it was all carried on in the heat of an unhappy passion, that his client, meaning me, had a sharp, provoking tongue, that I used them ill, jibing at them and jeering them, even while they believed me to be the very person, and that I had provoked them and the like. My attorney managed as well on my side, made them believe I was a widow of fortune, that I was able to do myself justice, and had great friends to stand by me too, who had all made me promise to sue to the utmost, and that if it cost me £1,000 I would be sure to have satisfaction, for that the affronts I had received were insufferable. However, they brought my attorney to this, that he promised he would not blow the coals, that if I inclined to accommodation he would not hinder me, and that he would rather persuade me to peace than to war, for which, they told him, he should be no loser, all which he told me very honestly, and told me that if they offered him any bribe I should certainly know it. But upon the whole he told me very honestly that if I would take his opinion he would advise me to make it up with them, for that as they were in a great fright, and were desirous above all things to make it up, and knew that, let it be what it would, they would be allotted to bear all the costs of the suit, he believed they would give me freely more than any jury or court of justice would give upon a trial. I asked him what he thought they would be brought to. He told me he could not tell as to that, but he would tell me more when I saw him again. Sometime after this they came again to know if he had talked with me. He told me he had, that he found me not so averse to an accommodation as some of my friends were, who resented the disgrace offered me and set me on, that they blowed the coals in secret, prompting me to revenge or do myself justice, as they called it, so that he could not tell what to say to it. He told them he would do his endeavour to persuade me, but he ought to be able to tell what proposal they made. They pretended they could not make any proposal, because it might be made use of against them, and he told them that by the same rule he could not make any offers, for that might be pleaded in abatement of what damages a jury might be inclined to give. However, after some discourse and mutual promises that no advantage should be taken on either side by what was transacted then or at any other of those meetings, they came to a kind of a treaty, but so remote and so wide from one another that nothing could be expected from it. For my attorney demanded £500 and charges, and they offered £50 without charges. So they broke it off, and the mercer proposed to have a meeting with me myself, and my attorney agreed to that very readily. My attorney gave me notice to come to this meeting in good clothes and with some state, that the mercer might see I was something more than I seemed to be that time they had me. Accordingly, I came in a new suit of second mourning, according to what I had said at the justice's. I set myself out, too, as well as a widow's dress in second mourning would admit. My governess also furnished me with a good pearl necklace, that shut in behind with a locket of diamonds which she had in pawn, and I had a very good figure, and as I stayed till I was sure they were come, I came in a coach to the door, with my maid with me. When I came into the room, the mercer was surprised. He stood up and made his bow, which I took a little notice of, and but a little, and went and sat down where my own attorney had pointed to me to sit, for it was his house. After a little while the mercer said he did not know me again, and began to make some compliments his way. I told him I believed he did not know me at first, and that if he had, I believed he would not have treated me as he did. He told me he was very sorry for what had happened, and that it was to testify the willingness he had to make all possible reparations that he had appointed this meeting, that he hoped I would not carry things to extremity, which might be not only too great a loss to him, but might be the ruin of his business and shop, in which case I might have the satisfaction of repaying an injury with an injury 10 times greater, but that I would then get nothing, but that he was willing to do me any justice that was in his power, without putting himself or me to the trouble or charge of a suit at law. I told him I was glad to hear him talk so much more like a man of sense than he did before, that it was true acknowledgment in most cases of affronts was counted reparation sufficient, but this had gone too far to be made up so, that I was not revengeful, nor did I seek his ruin, or any man's else, but that all my friends were unanimous not to let me so far neglect my character as to adjust a thing of this kind without a sufficient reparation of honour, that to be taken up for a thief was such an indignity as could not be put up, that my character was above being treated so by any that knew me, but because, in my condition of a widow, I had been for some time careless of myself and negligent of myself, I might be taken for such a creature, but that for the particular usage I had from him afterwards. And then I repeated all as before. It was so provoking, I had scarce patience to repeat it. Well, he acknowledged all, and was might humble indeed. He made proposals very handsome. He came up to £100, and to pay all the law charges, and added that he would make me a present of a very good suit of clothes. I came down to £300, and I demanded that I should publish an advertisement of the particulars in the common newspapers. This was a clause he could never comply with. However, at last he came up, by good management of my attorney, to £150 and a suit of black silk clothes. And there I agree, and, as it were, at my attorney's request, complied with it, he paying my attorney's bill and charges, and gave us a good supper into the bargain. When I came to receive the money, I brought my governess with me, dressed like an old duchess, and a gentleman very well dressed, whom we pretended courted me, but I called him cousin, and the lawyer was only to hint privately to him that his gentleman courted the widow. He treated us handsomely indeed, and paid the money cheerfully enough, so that it cost him £200 in all, or rather more. At our last meeting, when all was agreed, the case of the journeyman came up, and the mercer begged very hard for him, told me he was a man that had kept a shop of his own and been in good business, had a wife and several children, and was very poor, that he had nothing to make satisfaction with, but he should come to beg my pardon on his knees if I desired it, as openly as I pleased. I had no spleen at the saucy rogue, nor were his submissions anything to me, since there was nothing to be got by him, so I thought it was as good to throw that in generously as not. So I told him I did not desire the ruin of any man, and therefore, at his request, I would forgive the wretch. It was below me to seek any revenge. When we were at supper, he brought the poor fellow in to make acknowledgment, which he would have done with as much mean humility as his offence was with insulting haughtiness and pride, in which he was an instance of a complete baseness of spirit, impious, cruel, and relentless when uppermost and in prosperity, abject and low-spirited when down in affliction. However, I abated his cringes, told him I forgave him, and desired he might withdraw, as if I did not care for the sight of him, though I had forgiven him. I was now in good circumstances indeed, if I could have known my time for leaving off, and my governess often said I was the richest of all the trade in England, and so I believed it was, for I had £700 by me in money, besides clothes, rings, some plate, and 2 gold watches, and all of them stolen, for I had innumerable jobs besides these I have mentioned. Oh, had I even now had the grace of repentance, I had still leisure to have looked back upon my follies and have made some reparation. But the satisfaction I was to make for the public mischiefs I have done was yet left behind, and I could not forbear going abroad again, as I called it now, than any more I could when my extremity really drove me out for bread. End of section 17.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC Health/whatsyourwhy.